This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
We've essentially created this world in which there's a giant exemption to the Fourth Amendment based on this notion that you've shared this data with a third party, so you can't possibly have any privacy interest in it.
So it's a loophole you can drive a truck through.
Welcome to Politicology. I'm Ron Steslow. When most people hear spying, they think of James Bond sneaking into a secret facility and copying the data off of a hard drive, or agents holed up in a surveillance van, spending days listening to their target's conversation, or maybe Sydney Bristow tailing her target to learn where a covert base is. It's a lot of hacking and hustling, but what if I told you you didn't need to hack a computer to get the data? You just need a credit card or a government expense account. Every day, you're generating thousands of pieces of data: where you are, what numbers you call, how long each phone call is, what websites you visit. Information that, if the right person looks, can give away where you live and where you work, whether you've had a heart attack, whether you're seeking an abortion. And because you're probably the only one who spends almost every night in your house and then drives to your office every day, it's not difficult at all to trace all of that data back to you, not some anonymized collection of data points. All of this data is for sale. And some of the biggest customers buying it all up are three-letter agencies inside the federal government who are prohibited by law from collecting it themselves. Today, we're pulling back the curtain on this secretive industry, how opaque these systems are, why these surveillance agencies are working hard to make sure you don't know about it, and what you can do about it. There's no one better to unpack all of this than Byron Tao. Byron is the author of Means of Control: How the Hidden Alliance of Tech and Government is Creating a New American Surveillance State. He's also an investigative reporter and enterprise journalist who specializes in law, courts, and national security. Currently, he works at the All Britain Journalism Institute, a journalism nonprofit that trains and mentors early career reporters and writes for their publication, Notus. Previously, he worked at Wall Street Journal and Politico. At the Journal, he covered the White House during the Obama administration. He covered Congress with a focus on the Intelligence, Oversight, and Judiciary Committees. He was also a legal affairs and national security correspondent. And at Politico, he covered the White House, lobbying, campaign finance, and politics. Byron, welcome to Politicology.
Thanks so much for having me.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
So before we begin, maybe I should offer a trigger warning for my friends who were or were part of the national security community and whose dedicated work of stopping bad guys from doing bad things has been at least to some degree enabled by the kind of surveillance we're going to talk about today. So before we begin, why don't you set the stage, talk about your background a bit and how you landed on writing this book?
Sure. So you summarized my professional biography pretty well, but basically I had a pretty conventional career as a political reporter and bounced around the political beats until after the 2016 election, when I washed up on Capitol Hill as a correspondent. And that's when I started to get more into the intelligence community and the intelligence committees, because obviously the Russia investigation and the Mueller investigation were big stories then. And increasingly, I got drawn into national security reporting. In 2018, I switched beats to be sort of a Justice Department courts legal affairs reporter, and I was brand new on that particular beat. I had some understanding of national security, but I was basically hunting around for interesting stories to tell. As a kind of a new reporter on the beat, sometimes you don't have deep sourcing in the department you're covering, so you look for other angles. And one of the things I stumbled into as a phenomenon was the fact that I found out that the government, specifically the Pentagon, was the earliest version of this tip, was buying large amounts of consumer information about the U.S. population in some cases, but generally it was the whole globe, and was using it for counterterrorism and manhunting. And I dug deeper and deeper into this world and would come to find out that indeed the Department of Homeland Security was doing something similar, with the data focused much more on the United States and the U.S. borders. And eventually this kind of data would trickle down to everyone from these top-tier intelligence agencies to local police departments, which increasingly also started getting this kind of consumer or commercial data. And this is data that was very invasive. It was mapping the movement of phones through the world. And as you said, a data set like that is very hard to anonymize. So this had real privacy and civil liberties consequences. And so I started writing about it, first for the Wall Street Journal, and then it culminated in this book.
Well, as I mentioned before we began recording, I've spent a lot of time in marketing, digital marketing, and in particular in the political setting. So there was a lot of the functionality of this ad tech that wasn't new to me, but what was new was the degree to which the three-letter agencies and law enforcement in particular had become such sort of voracious consumers of this data behind the scenes. It's not something that we often think about or talk about, even as marketers. So I want to get to that metadata and sort of explaining to people just how rich it can be. Before we do, though, you start the book in the aftermath of 9/11. Can you talk about how these commercial data firms we're talking about responded to those attacks?
Sure. So basically in the book, I break down data brokers into four separate generations. The first generation of data brokers sprung up in the 1960s, and they were doing actually fairly basic things, like collecting addresses, maybe doing a little demographics by marrying addresses with the census data, and generally branching eventually into things like consumer preferences, right? They might buy up a list of magazine subscribers and see what they could infer from that, right? Did so-and-so subscribe to Golf Digest or Dog Fancy, and what did that mean about them as a consumer? So these were really the early data brokers, and they were doing something that wasn't that different from like a phone book company or a mass mailing company. But over time, data brokers changed because a wider variety of information became available on the global population. So the second generation of data brokers I described are these companies that sprung up to monitor what's being said on social media and broker that data to willing buyers. And then eventually we got into this ad tech data that you're talking about, which is essentially data on the movement of devices and people and their consumer preferences on their phones and marrying all that data to target them for ads on their computers and their phones. And the final generation of data brokers are weird, esoteric data brokers. I call it gray data. Sometimes it's data that's just out there for the taking. That can be things like internet logs that are generated as you load websites, or it can be things as strange as your Bluetooth headphones, right? Those give off signals, and there are these strange data brokers out there that are collecting all of the Bluetooth signals out there in the world. And so in this story, I trace the evolution of these data brokers and their relationship with government over the course of a 20-year timeframe. And I start with 9/11 because that's a moment in which the mission of the United States government switches, right? Before 9/11, the U.S. was very focused on a state adversary, the Soviet Union, and to a lesser extent, other countries that we thought posed a geopolitical challenge. But after 9/11, all of a sudden, you have to start looking for individual people who may be anomalies, or they may stick out because of their behavior. And that's when there became this tremendous interest in acquiring commercial or consumer data, because the people that we were now looking at were no longer, you know, the officials of nation states, but were in fact ordinary people living in apartments in Germany or renting cars in Florida. So my book traces the evolution of these data brokers as the technology changes and as their relationship with the government changes.
I think most people will be familiar with the uproar we saw in the wake of Edward Snowden's revelations about the NSA's program called PRISM, which was essentially hoovering up all kinds of what we refer to as metadata about Americans and foreigners' communications that flow through the United States. And we'll get to that later on, I think, in the conversation about the laws that changed and what the state of the law is now. But before we do, I want to talk about this metadata. Can you lay out for listeners who we don't want to alienate with any jargon, right? What types of data we're actually talking about here, and what these companies actually collect and what they don't collect?
Sure. So it depends on the data broker that we're talking about. As I said, early data brokers were actually collecting actual consumer information that included stuff like your name, your address history, and linking that to things like sometimes your voting records or your criminal history or your driving records, public records that were available in government databases. Then as data brokers changed to be more social focused, they were collecting data from social handles. So sometimes, depending on the social network, you might post under your own name, and other times you might post under a handle that isn't linked to your identity. But this was basically the brokering of large-scale social data. But as we moved into a world in which more and more things were networked, then we start getting into more obscure kinds of data, or data that doesn't necessarily link to a specific person under their, say, their name or their phone number or their address, but still can be traced back to them. And that's what we talk about when we talk about metadata. It's data about data, or it's data about devices. Sometimes it's, these vendors call it anonymized, but really it's pseudonymized, right? There's a hash or a number given to a piece of data that represents an individual, but it doesn't necessarily have names or faces in it. And in these ad tech data sets that we're talking about, it's essentially a unique identifier that Google and Apple have given to every device, every phone and tablet in the world running their operating system. And this identifier was given to devices in order to, in theory, protect privacy, because they didn't necessarily want real names being passed back from the device to all these advertisers that want to serve targeted ads. But when you start collecting data like location data, you know, it's very, very hard to anonymize data like that, right? Because I'm the only person that gets up every day at my home address and bikes along the National Mall to my office in Georgetown, right? So even if my name isn't in a data set of Washington, D.C., it wouldn't be that difficult if somebody really wanted to look into it to figure out which device belongs to me. And that is the privacy risk that I catalog that's posed by these large data sets that companies are saying are anonymized, but really in reality, if you have enough time and you have some other data sets to merge it with, and you're a pretty good government intelligence analyst, you can unmask or identify people pretty easily.
So to acknowledge the devil's advocate in the room without actually playing him or her, one of the most common defenses of the practice of sweeping up all this data and actually accessing it like a federal prosecutor might without a probable cause warrant, is they'll say something like, well, this is just the stuff on the outside of the envelope, right? They say, we can't see what's inside without a warrant, which in my view is a deceptively simple way to deflect from the essence of the concern, sort of by invoking this quaint image of dropping a handwritten envelope in a mailbox. You're obscuring what you can actually discern from the ocean of data we're actually talking about, far beyond just your name and your address. Can you give us a sense of the richness of a profile that an ad tech vendor, a data broker can paint with access to all of the data points that we're talking about when they're put together and analyzed?
Sure. So, billions, if not trillions of dollars have been poured into this system by America's largest corporations because they want to serve targeted ads to people, right? They want to understand where people are in the world, what they're doing, what they're buying, and what they're looking up on the internet, primarily for the purpose of giving them products and services that corporations think or hope that people will want. The reality is, though, all of this data can be tied together in a single identity. And can give a pretty holistic picture of a person. So for example, data brokers collect a lot of information about consumer purchases or household consumer purchases, and they get it from things like loyalty programs or, those cards you get at the pharmacy or the grocery store. You've sort of probably agreed to allow that company to sell your data to some data broker. They get information about your browsing history sometimes. When you look up a product and an advertiser puts a little cookie on your browser, that can be linked to you or your consumer profile in some cases. When you download a weather app and you allow it to have 24/7 location access, that weather app often makes your data available for sale. And so corporations can get that information and tie it to you and say, well, where does this device go? Does it go to the gym or does it go to the gun range? And can we serve ads based on that information? So this is a pretty rich repository of information about people that in many cases can be tied back to them or their real world identity either fairly easily or with a little bit of digging.
You talk about something which was quite startling to me, which is these SDKs, which stands for software development kits. And in, computer programming world, these are sort of sets of tools that developers use to build apps, all kinds of apps. But there was one story about a software development kit that was sort of intentionally designed to collect data that wasn't even necessary for many of these apps to function. So I'd love for you to explain, first of all, how the data gets to these brokers in the first place, the role that software developer kits play in that, who essentially what the business motive is of the people who release software development kits. And can you tell us more about that story where I can't remember which three-letter agency it was that was sort of closely linked to the release of it, and how it essentially functioned as a front for the government to buy through a private entity a lot of data that wasn't even necessary for the apps to function.
Sure. So essentially, mobile app development has become big business, and mobile apps have a lot of information about the global population. So, of course, they've become a target for both corporations to try to collect data from them and also governments to try to understand the world and to try to, in some cases, target specific individuals. And so, software development kits are basically pre-written lines of code that are out there and available for developers to take and put into their app when they develop a new product, a new app. So in many cases, there are some pre-written lines of code that will help a developer do a certain thing. And there are these software development kits out there that will actually help you monetize your app, right? So if you take a data broker's SDK and you put it in your app, and you get a certain number of your app's users to enable a precise location, the data broker will collect information from those people and pay you money because you've delivered them some data. And that way you can avoid charging 99 cents or $1.99 for your app. You can offer it for free. You can still make a little money by selling your consumers, your users' information to a data broker. This is a pretty common practice, and the book documents a lot of the ways in which data that's collected from these SDKs is in fact flowing to government entities and government agencies. Some of that is what I'll call above board. These are just vendors. They're location brokers. They're collecting location from hundreds or tens of, or thousands of apps, and they're selling it in a commercial transaction to governments. But in some cases, I found some less above board or sneakier ways to insert data, ways in which the developer of the app didn't even necessarily know what the software development kit was doing or who was really behind it. So I have this story about a Panamanian-based company called Measurement Systems, and it was going around the world and targeting developers of apps in places like Eastern Europe or in Africa or in the Middle East and saying, hey, would you put our SDK in your app in exchange for doing that, you'll get some money from us and we'll collect the data from your users. But what I found in trying to unwind this, and I did so with the help of these two computer scientists who actually initially had found the code, was that this actually seemed to be a government-linked data collection project. I never got quite to the bottom of where it was going, but it was pretty clear that when you looked into it, that it seemed to be a government-linked data collection effort. And it was doing some pretty invasive things, right? It was actually scanning the downloads folder of people's WhatsApp accounts, which is in theory a private communication service, but this app was scanning it. It was mapping out other devices in the house. So it was like looking at where the router was and what the router's name was. It was scanning the signal environment around the phone for other devices like Bluetooth headphones and other things around it. So it was actually behaving in very strange ways for a commercial app. And many of these developers at least told me that they didn't actually realize what it was doing. So this is the reality of 21st century technology, right? That developers are incentivized to put the software code in their apps, and they don't necessarily know who is behind it, what it's doing, or who's getting the data at the end of the day.
Can you talk a little bit more about the signal scanning function and exactly what is produced by all of these devices all over the place, beyond just your phone, in the constant scanning of their environments and picking up signals? Where is all of that going? What purpose does it serve?
You know, honestly, I wish I knew. I never quite got the full answer to exactly what governments were doing. But essentially, take your cell phone, right? Your cell phone has a bunch of radio receivers in it. That's how it communicates with the cell tower. And it also has a sensor that can detect Wi-Fi networks and Bluetooth devices, right? Because, you know, you want to connect your smartwatch to it, or you want to connect your AirPods to it. All makes sense. All is how the technology works. It's how consumers connect things to it and get information to and from the device. But those sensors actually have a secondary purpose. And sometimes the apps that consumers put on their phone can access those sensors and start scanning the environment around the phone. And I documented a number of government-linked brokers or government-linked efforts to do exactly that with a distributed network of millions of phones around the world. Some of these phones were mapping out the cell tower networks of foreign countries. That could potentially be interesting in a cyber attack of some kind. Some of these programs were mapping out things like wireless access points, also a potential sort of recon effort to potentially do some sort of cyber offensive operation. And some of them were mapping out the location of Bluetooth devices or, essentially they were spotting headphones in the wild and collecting information and saying, I saw this Bluetooth headphone at this particular location. What exactly they're doing with that data, I could never really figure out. It seems to have some potential cybersecurity or intelligence application that is really beyond me.
I'm sure listeners are thinking right now, hang on, I have a right to privacy. I have a Fourth Amendment right against unreasonable search and seizure. Can you talk about what the legal right to privacy currently looks like in the United States and how fragile it is?
Sure. So essentially, there are some constitutional guarantees, right? Like the Fourth Amendment protects you against unreasonable searches and seizures. Also in the mid-20th century, the Supreme Court started to say, if you squint hard enough at the Constitution, there might be some sort of right to privacy in there, right? So there was a series of rulings that indicated that, you know, when a couple used birth control or when a woman sought an abortion, that potentially the right to privacy existed in the Constitution if you looked hard enough at the kind of the gist of the document. Unfortunately, as time went on, the court sort of backed away from this interpretation, and the modern Supreme Court is less inclined to see these unenumerated rights in the Constitution. The thing about the Fourth Amendment, which is the sort of last remaining major barrier to the government's acquisition of information about its citizens is that there is this doctrine called the third party doctrine, which is basically an exemption to the Fourth Amendment. And what it says is, if you share some piece of information with a third party, you've actually lost the privacy interest in it that's core to protecting your Fourth Amendment rights. So for example, if you give your cell phone company the number that you want to dial, you actually lose the privacy interest in the data about who you're calling, because you've told the cell phone company, hey, I want to connect to, you know, 202 whatever. So the government's view and the interpretation of the courts is that data that you share with the third party does not have Fourth Amendment protections. And that's why the government was able to run a large-scale metadata program that Edward Snowden revealed, where they captured the numbers that everyone was dialed. They need a search warrant to listen in on the phone call, but they don't need a search warrant to see your social network, to see who you call and for how long. And that was possibly okay when all we were talking about were things like banking records or the numbers that we dial on our phones. But as the amount of data that third parties had about us increased, we're now living in a world where we basically can't do anything in modern life without giving over some information to a third party. And in many cases, those third parties are making that data available for sale. In other cases, governments can just go ask for it or get a subpoena, which is a lesser standard than a warrant. And so we've essentially created this world in which there's a giant exemption to the Fourth Amendment based on this notion that you've shared this data with a third party, so you can't possibly have any privacy interest in it.
So it's a loophole you can drive a truck through, essentially.
I think that's right, especially as the amount of data that we increasingly hand over to third parties is increasing, right? At one point, it was just things like banking records and cell phone and cell numbers dialed. But today, it's basically everything, right? Our cars generate data, our phones generate data, we put information on social media, the ads that were served when we browse the web generate data, and all of that data is in the hands of these third parties. And so the prevailing interpretation of the courts is that you voluntarily shared this information, so what possible privacy protection should the state offer you?
Yeah. Sharing data with a third party now looks nothing like it used to, because there's a whole lot less volition involved. When your entire life revolves around, relies upon third parties facilitating everything, where is the volition? You know, I spoke with Kashmir Hill a couple of weeks ago, who, by the way, is how I learned about your amazing work. She's very much looking forward to your book. And we were talking about facial recognition software. She has a line in her book describing the private-public collaboration on surveillance. Here's how she described it. Private vendors selling law enforcement agencies the fruit of surveillance methods that would likely be unconstitutional if deployed by the government itself. So can you talk about how you've seen that dynamic specifically play out across this reporting?
Yeah, in my book, I'm essentially describing the same thing that Kashmir is. She focuses on facial recognition. I focus much more on data brokers, but it's the same phenomenon of private vendors obtaining large amounts of information about the population. In some cases, information that that government agencies might not be allowed to get themselves, and selling it back to governments. And, you know, this is one of the core civil liberties and privacy challenges of the 21st century, because corporations have tremendous amounts of information about us. And in many cases, it's much more information than governments have, right? That's a dramatic shift from the 20th century, when it was the government that had the best information about the population, right? Census records and tax records, passport records, those gave the government a tremendous amount of power. But today, it's actually corporations that know almost everything we do, right? They know what we search on the internet, who we're communicating with, what we say in private online spaces in many cases, what we buy. This is a tremendous amount of insight into the routines, the habits, and the predilections of the population. And governments are very, very hungry to obtain that kind of information at scale. And so there are these emerging public-private partnerships where corporations collect the data for commercial purposes, and then that data finds its way through the commercial market to the government.
Yeah, let's talk about this change over time, because at the end of the first chapter, you quote a DoD lawyer who had heard about someone talking up one of those early commercial tools, and he told him, "This is the DoD. We don't do that shit," which was hilarious. But how have DoD and intelligence agencies and law enforcement changed their attitudes toward using this data over time?
Right. So there was an initial reluctance, in lots of quarters about obtaining large amounts of commercial information. There was a big debate in the Justice Department early on in the early 2000s about whether to, get a data broker subscription to something like LexisNexis, which basically lets you look up addresses. And then I described this anecdote in the book where a similar data broker was trying to sell a security tool to the DoD, and this lawyer expressed deep discomfort with it. There was an early effort by Admiral John Poindexter to stand up a program called Total Information Awareness that was going to vacuum up lots and lots of consumer commercial data and combine it with the government's classified data to try to, find terrorists and foil ongoing or future terrorist plots. And that created this outcry from civil libertarians. And Congress actually defunded this program. But the research on this actually never really stops, even though there's this outcry, even though DoD lawyers are uncomfortable. And eventually, government lawyers essentially come to the conclusion that, well, if we're acting as a buyer, if this is commercially available information that's available to anyone, corporations, marketers, investigative journalists, why shouldn't the state be able to use it, right? And that's actually a fairly powerful argument that government lawyers say, Home Depot can use this data to target ads, and our mission is much more important than selling patio furniture or grills. Why can't we have it also? And over time, that view has largely won out. There are civil liberties and privacy protections baked into many of these programs. Generally speaking, people aren't supposed to be looking up their spouses or their dates on these government systems. But if you're using it for some sort of lawful mission, government lawyers have by and large blessed this idea that, if it's data that's available commercially and we obtain it lawfully in a commercial transaction, we can use it for whatever mission we need to.
These early programs like Total Information Awareness, which you mentioned, which just the name of it sounds completely Orwellian, happened before the widespread adoption of social media and smartphones. Can you talk a little bit about how those two things changed the playing field and how much social media has changed our idea of what privacy means and how much of it we ought to be entitled to?
Right. So many of these early efforts were indeed set up before we allowed a smartphone into our lives, before we started posting everything about ourselves in these very, very public forums. And there was this privacy outcry from civil libertarians like Senator Ron Wyden and others in Congress that were deeply uncomfortable with what the Pentagon and other agencies were proposing to do. But social norms started to shift shortly after 9/11 with the advent of social media sites that became quite popular. First, MySpace and Facebook, and then Twitter and Instagram, and later TikTok and Be Real and whatever else comes next, right? There was this impulse to start putting things about your lives on the internet, your opinions, your photos, where you go. And all of that had tremendous intelligence value, right? We saw terrorist groups like ISIS begin to use the internet to try to recruit people, to put propaganda into the information ecosystem. And so governments became increasingly interested in using social media to do intelligence, trying to figure out where ISIS units were, trying to see relationships between people. Then as mobile phones came into our lives and we started allowing hundreds of app developers detailed information about where we go, what's on our phone, what we're looking up. Corporations started trying to take advantage of that data too, to do targeted advertising and figure out things about where to put, the next location of a Starbucks or something like that. But of course, governments also wanted to use that data, right? Because again, there's this idea that if corporations are using it, our mission is important too. In fact, it's probably more important. We should have access to the same data. So as technology and as social norms changed and as these platforms and the way in which we use technology evolved, government use evolved along with it.
Yeah, you also wrote about how obviously social media generated a ton more data that government started vacuuming up as publicly available, put that in air quotes, but that actually collecting it was in violation of the company's terms of service. And you also heard about police departments creating, or in some cases, buying from vendors, fake accounts for the purpose of surveilling Americans, which was also against the terms of service of these very companies. So maybe a little bit on the forces in government that were willing to ignore the terms of service in the first place, but also why were these companies, at least in some cases, so lax in their enforcement when it came to government violations of their terms?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I think the social media companies have seesawed a bit on this over the years. Initially, for example, Twitter, the way it conceived of itself was a very public platform, right? It was encouraging people to post things publicly. You actually didn't really even need a Twitter account to see what people were saying on Twitter. There's no paywall. There was nothing, right? So you could just log in, or you didn't even need to log in, right? You could just go to twitter.com/username and see what any individual was saying. And so Twitter in early on allowed these vendors to sell the bulk Twitter feed to people that wanted to, see what people were saying about their brand. And of course, governments became quickly interested in acquiring the same data, right? Because there was this desire to see what terrorists were saying, to find criminals who were bragging about their exploits online, and to generally monitor the social conversation. Then came the 2014 2014 racial justice protests after the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson and then later Freddie Gray the next year. The ACLU and other groups during that time period identified the fact that many local police departments were purchasing large amounts of social data from sites like Twitter, but also closed or semi-closed networks like Facebook and Instagram, and were using it to monitor protesters, to infiltrate these groups in some instances, to figure out what activists were saying and to gather intelligence on them. So social media companies became a little bit more reticent to do government sales, but government demand for this data never went away. And the way that many of these vendors identified as being able to continue to provide this service is to create fake accounts or to scrape the data against the terms of service of the site. And governments are willing to pay for this, right? Because in many instances, they're saying that, we have a very important mission here. We're trying to stop ISIS. We're trying to stop the next terrorist attack. We're trying to identify people who burned down downtown of a city during unrest. And so government interest in this data never went away, and they find it in their interest to partner with vendors who are doing things that are technically against the terms of service of these social media sites.
Thank you to everyone at home and on the go for listening. And make sure you're subscribed so you get notified when the second part of this conversation drops next week. You can support the show by joining the growing, thriving community of Politicology Plus members and gain access to hours of special content designed to help you think like a political strategist and look further down the road than everyone else and understand the forces and figures shaping the fight for democracy. You can unlock this premium content at politicology.com/plus. If you have any questions about anything we've talked about, you can reach us, as always, at podcast@politicology.com. Even if we can't respond, we do read everything you send us, whether it's an episode idea, a guest recommendation, or just a simple note about how the show has impacted you. And we love hearing from you. I'm Ron Steslow. I'll see you in the next episode.